Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear how people desperate to get a COVID-19 vaccination are driving some long distances. A state lawmaker tells her story of grief and why she's fighting to expand trauma services to help crime victims. And a sports writer discusses the death of his grandson to substance abuse. He's written a book about it.
You know, so I wanted to do it because it told a story about youth, about kids, you know, who feel left out, kids who feel pain. But it's an important book in the sense that he didn't choose to be addicted. Addicted chose him.
A deported veteran is brought back to Illinois to be buried. What his family has to say. We'll hear about the challenge to improve water quality in rural communities. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear some personal stories of loss. One from a state lawmaker, another from a well-known sports writer from Central Illinois. How their work has allowed them to cope and help others. State laws are different when it comes to meatpacking plants and the workers' eligibility for COVID-19 vaccines. We'll also hear how a musician has adapted to playing without a live audience. That's just some of what's ahead on Statewide. First up, COVID-19 vaccine is slowly trickling into the St. Louis region. Eligible residents desperate for a shot say they have trouble finding one close to home. Kayla Drake reports some people are driving up to 3 hours away for the vaccine.
Nadine Hudson was determined to get the COVID-19 vaccine. She heard from friends that the more rural the area, the easier it is to score a dose. So she started scouring the internet.
I just pulled up maps and I went through the counties. I looked at their population and I wanted to get populations that was smaller.
After 10 hours of research, the retired South St. Louis County resident spotted a clip in a Perryville newspaper. The Perry County Health Department promised 975 doses to the first people who showed up. She left at 2:30 a.m. and got vaccinated a few hours later. The scarcity of the vaccine in St. Louis has prompted scores of eligible St. Louis area residents, like Hudson, to embark on road trips into rural Missouri. People have traveled all over the state for the prize shot, from Hannibal.
And I thought, you know, I might as well try to get on in Hannibal too, just for the heck of it.
To Caruthersville.
We didn't want to travel down that far, but like we always say, you have to go where the vaccine is.
And Cape Girardeau.
I know that there were many more than 10 people from St. Louis that were down there that day.
That was Lori Vincent, Richard Randall, and Mary Dunger. Just a few examples of people who could only find vaccine outside of St. Louis. And the reason people are traveling so far is that the St. Louis region has lower amounts of vaccine per capita than rural areas. That's according to Dr. Alex Garza, who leads the St. Louis Metropolitan Pandemic Task Force.
We're in this region where we're vaccine poor, and we're trying to figure out what is the most equitable way to distribute vaccine when there's so many places that have no vaccine.
Missouri Governor Mike Parson disagrees and says the state's allocations are fair. But Missouri counties in the St. Louis metro fall below the state average for vaccinations per capita. And the number of doses coming into the St. Louis region dwarfs in comparison to demand. Just over 33,000 doses are shipped a week. Garza estimates more than 700,000 people are eligible for the vaccine in the St. Louis area. Mary Dunger, the woman who traveled to Cape Girardeau, says for every one person who has been vaccinated in the St. Louis area, she knows five that have traveled outside the region to get one. Dunger, a North St. Louis County resident, says she knows the people who can afford vaccine trips are the ones who are going. These trips often take up an entire day with little notice. That's nearly impossible for eligible people who have strict job schedules or who rely on public transportation to make the same journey.
You know, I can see that there's a privilege there that I don't feel good about, but I didn't create the situation. Anybody I know that's done this has had internet access and been able to easily, once they become aware of the possibility, they're able to get out there online and pursue it.
So if you can travel outside the region to get the vaccine, should you? One bioethicist says you should think twice. Nancy Berlinger is a researcher at the Hastings Center, a think tank in New York. She says people who are able to travel should ask themselves if they're really the most vulnerable.
So you could both be crowding out people in a rural area and also kind of queue jumping over people closer to home who really need access but can't make that, 200-mile round trip. So it's not a strategy that helps people most at risk of COVID.
Health officials in rural areas agree. Cape Girardeau's Health Department Director Jane Wernsman says she doesn't mind that people are coming to her town for the vaccine, but it's not ideal. She would rather they receive a vaccination closer to home.
So that we're able to vaccinate a few more individuals from within the region with vaccine that is here and give them the opportunity not to have to travel.
But still, many in St. Louis are desperate and able, so they're willing to take the drive. I'm Kayla Drake.
Governor J.B. Pritzker introduced his budget framework for next year on Wednesday. It's a plan that avoids an across-the-board tax hike and deep cuts to social services. Both of those were consequences he'd warned of after his graduated income tax plan failed at the polls in November. But as Hannah Meisel reports, Pritzker has few loud cheerleaders for his spending blueprint.
The $3.5 billion of extra annual revenue that Pritzker had hoped for as a result of the graduated income tax are nowhere to be found in his proposed budget.
I had bolder plans for our state budget than what I'm going to present to you today. But as all of our families have had to make hard choices over the last year, so too does state government.
On Wednesday, Pritzker presented his spending plan virtually, instead of to the usual crowd of lawmakers, statewide office holders, and other guests in the state capitol. But the budget plan does not bear either of the consequences he'd warned about when his signature tax plan failed. Instead of calling for an across-the-board income tax hike or deep cuts to state services, Pritzker is instead relying on some federal dollars and asking the General Assembly to approve slashing nearly $1 billion in what he calls corporate tax loopholes. But many of those so-called loopholes are what Republicans call
incentives to grow jobs and educate our children.
That's House Republican leader Jim Durkin of Western Springs. Durkin points out that Pritzker wasn't calling some of those tax incentives corporate loopholes when he signed them into law, not even 2 years ago. Pritzker helped negotiate that package of pro-business items at the end of his first legislative session in 2019, and then eagerly touted them as evidence of his ability to work with Republicans and the business community. Durkin says it's disingenuous that Pritzker would call those tax items loopholes.
There is a difference between loopholes and incentives. Incentives are what creates jobs, grow our economy, and keep our families in Illinois. Loopholes, on the other hand, are what tycoons use to avoid paying taxes in Illinois, like parking money in the Cayman Islands or using questionable property tax exemptions.
Those are shots at Pritzker, a billionaire heir to the Hyatt Hotels fortune. The governor has at least one investment in the Cayman Islands, and during the 2018 election, it was revealed that federal investigators were interested in how Pritzker got a $330,000 property tax cut after the toilets were removed from a second Chicago mansion he owns. But Pritzker had harsh words for Republicans in his budget speech, too.
In essence, they eliminated the fire department, burnt down the house, and poured gas on the flames, and now they're asking why we're not doing more to prevent fires.
He blamed GOP members of Congress for blocking federal aid and called Republicans in Illinois, quote, carnival barkers, who constantly criticize the governor's COVID response. But Republicans aren't the only lawmakers who have issues with Pritzker's spending plan. For the second year in a row, the governor says Illinois can't increase school funding in a promised 10-year ramp to reach an equity goal laid out under a 2017 law. Though Pritzker says federal funding will prevent schools from having to make budget cuts, Senate Majority Leader Kim Lightford, a leader in the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus, isn't fully sold on the governor's idea.
We must consider more thoroughly the consequences of pushing off yet again making investments in education. The longer we wait, the more students in lower resource schools suffer.
Other Democrats offered only tepid responses to Pritzker's speech Wednesday, calling the governor's proposal a starting point for negotiations. Some have quietly pushed back on the governor for months. Many lawmakers' district offices have turned into de facto triage centers for constituents having issues getting connected with unemployment insurance at the troubled Department of Employment Security. The governor is proposing more funding for IDES and other state agencies providing the most services to Illinoisans during the pandemic. but Pritzker ended his speech on a hopeful note from his pre-recording location at the State Fairgrounds in Springfield. During the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918, the grounds were used as a field hospital, and beginning this week, the fairgrounds opened as a mass COVID vaccination site. Pritzker framed that as a metaphor for the resiliency of Illinoisans.
Every year in August, these grounds have a much more joyful purpose as they host the Illinois State Fair. This place changes to meet the times.
I'm Hannah Meisel.
The Illinois State Representative Jahan Gordon Booth knows about pain and loss and trauma, and she's pushing for an expansion of trauma services in Illinois to help crime victims. It's a deeply personal mission. Patrick Smith has more on that.
In 2014, Representative Gordon Booth's son was murdered in their hometown of Peoria. She was 9 months pregnant at the time. She buried her 22-year-old son, and then 9 days later, she gave birth to her daughter.
You know, you bring a child into the world, it's such a beautiful experience, but you just had this dark cloud over you. And so at times, that was the only bright light that we had, was our, you know, our brand new baby girl.
Gordon Booth says it took her years to recover mentally and emotionally from her son's murder. She was racked with grief, and she felt isolated. She was suffering from symptoms of post-traumatic stress, but she says she's lucky. She and her husband had the resources and support system to get through it. The murder was solved, and that's when Gordon Booth saw the effect of trauma on others too, on the witnesses who testified at the trial, who watched as her son DJ was killed in front of them.
I saw the young women who were at this birthday party with him, who had never met him a day in their life, but they saw him have his life taken. I saw the pain and agony that they went through.
Gordon Booth says she kept up with those witnesses, saw them try in vain to get help for the emotional suffering they were going through. And she knew she wanted to use her power as a lawmaker to do something.
If I'm bleeding from the head, you immediately know what to do with me. You know, you take me to the ER. But when people are wounded from pain and from trauma, there has to be a place to deal with those traumas.
In 2016, Gordon Booth thought she found that place. She was on a trip to California, where she toured a new treatment center being piloted there. The crime victims and witnesses treated at the San Francisco Center were enveloped in help. They had a case manager who coordinated all their care and helped them navigate the healthcare system or apply for victims' assistance funds. They got group and individual therapy and financial help. Gordon Booth was convinced it was exactly what the hundreds of thousands of traumatized people in Illinois needed. The next year, she pushed to start a pilot program here in Illinois, using some federal money to start trauma recovery centers in her hometown of Peoria and another one on the southwest border of Chicago in the suburb of Evergreen Park. Now that effort is expanding, with a trio of new taxpayer-supported trauma recovery centers opening this winter in Rockford, Springfield, and the northern suburb of Gurnee. Each one gets about $1 million in public funding a year.
Trying to provide a remedy for people who literally have holes in their soul that will not repair themselves on their own.
Okay. So as you can tell from the piles of donations, a lot
of... Victoria Smoter is the lead clinical psychologist at the Trauma Recovery Center in Evergreen Park. It's affiliated with Advocate Christ Hospital. They see patients who have survived gunshots, witnessed murders, been victims of human trafficking or sexual assault. She says they provide therapy and emotional support. And sometimes the first step of therapy is simply paying for food or rent.
We have those really basic physiological needs like food, shelter, safety, and we're not getting beyond that if those things aren't met.
Smoter says success can be measured in ways that are both small and monumental.
We worked with someone about a year ago who had multiple instances of violence in his lifetime. He was coming to us for a multiple gunshot wound, and he hadn't taken public transportation in over a decade.
Smoter says this patient would have panic attacks while waiting for the bus, worried that someone would see him and he would be a target of violence again. So in therapy sessions, they talked about those fears, acknowledged that they came from a real place, but also worked out some techniques to deal with and overcome them so he could get a small piece of his life back. She says it took a few months of work.
He actually started taking the bus with 2 bus transfers to the gym on his own and was so excited about it. It changed his whole demeanor. So even like his body language, his affect, his face, it changed when talking about us and talking to us.
Lenore Anderson says the most important thing trauma recovery centers do is help people. But she also believes that helping trauma victims will ultimately improve public safety. Anderson is president of the Alliance for Safety and Justice, a national group that's been pushing for more trauma treatment across the country.
Oftentimes, the survivor of the incident has no trust in the system and is not trying to cooperate with the investigation. It's very difficult for those in law enforcement who are trying to address this when they don't have that trust, right? Well, working with the trauma recovery centers, having that advocate who understands the impact of trauma, sitting right next to the survivor, walking the survivor through the process of the justice system, what we've seen so many times is increased trust levels in justice, increased cooperation with investigations, and that's another way that this model is really about improving public safety.
I told myself at first that I didn't want to testify. I didn't know if I could stand to even look at this guy. I don't know, and they told me that they would come be with me if I needed. And I told them I don't know if I could.
That's Tina Rucker. The trial for the man who allegedly killed her nephew is scheduled to start today. Rucker helped raise her nephew. In 2019, she was watching as he was gunned down in front of their house. She says the Trauma Recovery Center helped her when she didn't know what to do. They gave her a support system, a therapist, a group of people who were always there for her and knew what she was going through. Rucker says after her nephew's murder, she was scared all the time. She couldn't stay in her house because the murder happened right out in front. She had nightmares. The center helped her move, paid her rent until she was able to get back to work. She's completed the program now, but the staff at the Trauma Recovery Center in Peoria, Rep. Gordon Booth's hometown, is still there for her.
They still reach out to me. They're family to me. They're my second home. If I didn't have them, I don't know what I would have did.
Rucker is back at work now, much stronger than in the months after she watched her nephew's killing. She says she is going to testify at the trial. More proof of the ways the trauma center helped piece things back together.
I'm ready. I'm ready and I'm stronger now.
Rucker says about a month ago, someone she knows lost her grandson to gun violence. She told the woman right away to go to the trauma recovery center. She told her they'll know how to help. I'm Patrick Smith.
There's more ahead on Statewide. Don't forget, you can find links to the stories you hear each week at our website, statewideshow.com. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, small rural communities and the challenge of improving the quality of water there. Next up, after COVID-19 ravaged hundreds of meatpacking plants across the country, several states prioritized vaccines for food processing workers. But as Christina Stella reports, many workers could end up waiting months to get the shot.
Leonila Gonzalez can't wait to get the COVID-19 vaccine.
She already knows what she'll do afterwards. Go to warm, sunny Texas and visit her family.
I want to travel. I want to go into somewhere else. Now I can go to see anybody because I don't want to go into anywhere. It's more safe for me and my family to stay in my home.
Gonzalez supervises the morning shift at Lincoln Premium Poultry's processing plant in Fremont, Nebraska, which provides chicken for Costco warehouses across the U.S. She saw her community really struggle with the virus and lost her own dad to the illness.
This virus is really bad. I want to protect myself and the people who stay around to me. Yeah, and for my family and everybody, I need to protect because I'm working with a lot of people.
About 250 of the plant's workers have gotten sick over the course of the pandemic, with two deaths. Cases in some bigger name plants across the region have been double or triple that number. In nearby Dakota City, Nebraska, nearly 800 workers at a Tyson beef plant tested positive last spring, forcing the facility to close for cleaning. Now that vaccines are cleared for use, many companies are eager to secure doses for their employees. Jessica Coulterman, a senior manager at the plant, says Lincoln Premium Poultry has tried its best to plan ahead.
Every one of our team members has been surveyed, and to date, we've had over 40% of our team members say that, yes, they would be excited to receive the vaccine. So we were really excited and ready to go.
The company is hoping to up that number. Some processors, like the mega packer JBS, are even offering bonuses to workers who get the shot. Lincoln Premium Poultry isn't one of them, but Coulterman says the company is partnering with local health officials to provide information about the vaccine, especially to hard-hit immigrant communities.
In our group specifically, we have people who are Spanish-speaking and we have people who are Karen-speaking. And so those are two communities that we'll focus on with our educational efforts.
And there are some less official efforts, too. Steve Key works on the same shift as Leonila Gonzalez. He's been talking up the vaccine with peers who might be on the fence, and even put on an impromptu skit one morning debunking misinformation.
If I can make a fool out of myself and convince one person that wasn't going to get it to take it, I feel like I will have won.
At first, he was one of the uncertain people. Then he saw the virus up close when his wife tested positive after Thanksgiving. She was sick for most of December.
After seeing it firsthand, I don't want it. My only question is, when is it going to be here?
That's manager Jessica Coulterman's question, too.
Ultimately, what will happen is I'll get a call from the health department and they'll say, we have vaccine for you. It may be 5, it may be 50, but we're going to have to mobilize immediately.
That call will come from Tara Ewing, executive director of the Three Rivers Public Health Department.
I can tell you I've got people beating on my door in every single industry trying to persuade us why they need to go first, and that isn't even up to me.
But many states, like Nebraska, are still trying to vaccinate other groups first, like people over 65, first responders, and teachers.
We got to really get the communities to understand this is not a bad rollout. This is not that we are not organized. We don't have the vaccine.
The shortage reflects larger supply concerns across the United States. Ewing only has about 900 doses a week to give across 3 counties.
We have allocated 61% to the 65 and older population going to our medical systems and pharmacy. So that's 550 doses. That leaves me 350 doses a week. That's not very many.
So even though meatpackers are prioritized in Nebraska and many other states, it will take weeks, if not longer, to start vaccinating most workers. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
For many rural towns across the country, improving water quality is an effort that takes years and millions of dollars to fix. Seth Bodine reports how some rural towns struggle to keep up with the improvements.
Cheryl Lefevre doesn't drink the water in the small town of Hobart, Oklahoma, without a filter. Without that filter, sometimes the water smells like chlorine or rust, or sometimes even comes out brown.
Some days it's like this, you know, clear and just fine, and some days it's got all of that gunk in it.
That gunk she's referring to, that's what she's seen in her filter. She says she has to clean it about every 2 weeks.
What is that in there?
I don't know, like dirt, deposits? I'm not sure. These little brown circle-like ones, that's a constant.
Despite the color and smell, a recent EPA report says the water is fine. But Hobart had even bigger problems about a decade ago. Sediment started filling up the lake, and the water had a lot of sediment in it. That caused all sorts of problems in the water.
The taste and odor was just so horrendous that we couldn't treat it.
That's Joe Tipton, the water superintendent for Hobart. He says the city is dredging the lake and revamping its water treatment facility. It's a huge undertaking and has a hefty price tag, up to $18 million. Still, the water sometimes comes out brown. Tipton says it might be due to the aging pipes in town. Lefevre says she sees improvement charges on her utility bill each month, but after 10 years, she's tired of waiting.
Granted, it's, you've got your sewer and trash and stuff on there as well, but $100 a month and I have to buy water and sometimes my dogs won't even drink it. It's frustrating.
City manager Ashley Slaughterbeck says replacing some of the old pipes in town is feasible, but not until work at Rocky Lake is finished. Checking off one improvement to move to another. Hubert isn't alone. Eric Olson is the strategic director of health at the Natural Resource Defense Council. He says small rural towns across the country often struggle to keep water safe.
They often have a disproportionate number of violations and compliance problems because they don't have the economies of scale, and therefore they often cannot afford the treatment that would be needed to remove contaminants.
The problem is so widespread that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has handed out nearly $900 million this year in loans and grants to rural towns in 43 states. It's supposed to update their water systems, but Olson says the money is a drop in the bucket compared to what's needed to solve the widespread problem in rural areas.
The total needs for upgrading and fixing drinking water systems in the U.S. are about $1 trillion.
Even when towns get the loans they need, they have to worry about paying it off. Bob Copeland is the city manager of Hollis, Oklahoma. His town of a little over 1,000 people received a mix of grants and loans from the USDA and Indian Health Service to help fix the nitrate violations in the water. And while the water is much better now, he worries about the town's ability to pay off the loans in the future.
We have a declining population, and we've had to raise our water rates to actually make our loan payments.
Small towns often have to decide if fixing the crumbling infrastructure is worth the price.
Seth Bodine with that report. Musicians across the world have had to accept performing without a live audience. One DeKalb folk musician has adapted to this and is still able to make a living doing what he loves. Yvonne Booz has his story.
Joe Jenks grew up in Rockford. He is the youngest of seven children. He says his family was always surrounded by music.
I would crawl under the piano as a kid, as a toddler, when other people were playing. I'd find a little cubby under there in between the instruments, the guitars and the cello and the trombone and everything else that was under there. I'd crawl in between them, and I would lay there and just listen to people make music.
Jenks explains that this was his safe space, and the sound waves floating through his body brought him comfort. He started writing songs at the age of 8, but he originally wanted to be an astronaut or a fire ranger. When that didn't pan out, he decided to follow the tunes in his heart.
I was born in Tulsa back in 1951.
Although Jenks grew up in a musical family, he credits Rockford jazz singer and former music teacher Dorothy Page Turner for changing the trajectory of his journey.
That woman changed my life. And I had a lot of musical influences. She was one of the people that bridged history for me and said, you're a part of this. You know, this is your torch to pick up and carry. This movement belongs to everybody who believes in it.
Jenks spent the last 25 years performing as a folk musician. He did between 120 and 160 concerts per year. He focused on live performances, but COVID-19 has made him concentrate on another medium.
I'm not a big fan of video. I sort of do it as needs be. Like it's sort of like going to the dentist. You know, it's not what I love to do, but I know that a lot of people enjoy having video to watch.
Jenks says he realized that it was time for him to learn new skills. He spent the second half of April through the first week of June doing what he calls a technical boot camp. This is where he immersed himself into the technology that he didn't understand. Jenks had already created a home studio in efforts to save money. He didn't realize that the new setup would turn into something else.
It's like somehow I built the ark before anybody told me there was going to be a flood. I spent Christmas break, 2019 into January of 2020, the first few days, building a space in the basement that was largely soundproofed and isolated so that I could do recording.
Why are the guns still firing?
He uses this space to give virtual concerts that he streams on his YouTube channel. He doesn't charge for the viewings. He states that the question for him is not what he can get from his fans, but what he can give them.
It's more like I'm a digital busker. I'm just standing on the street corner giving everything I have to give and trusting that if I do my job well, if I bring my heart and my soul and my humanity and my sincerity into it, it's going to move enough people to, you know, want to give back.
He does have PayPal and Venmo links for all his shows, but a payment isn't required. He says he's able to keep a roof over his head and pay the bills thanks to donations.
Well, if you have a minute, John, I sure feel like hell.
He plans on continuing these showings at least through April. Jenks also gives fans a peek of his soul through the essays on his website. Subjects range from his times in Ireland to messages of hope. Although the folk musician has outgrown the little cubby underneath his family's piano, he says he has a new safe space. And that's when he's in front of a microphone. He calls it his shield. Jenks is urging all creatives to find their safe space by following their heart's calling. He says the pandemic is giving people the time to tap into their talents. He expresses how focusing on what you can give to the world will help you attract so much more. I'm Yvonne Booz.
That one road turned to two. Most all of Illinois got a good dose of winter weather this past week, and it also marked another anniversary of the Great Blizzard of 1978. That was one of the worst storms in Illinois. Clint Cargill tells us the blizzard brought 12-foot snowdrifts in some places and temperatures so low that railroad tracks snapped. But he also tells us a couple of snowed-in computer nerds use that time wisely.
It was February 16, 1978, just after the Great Blizzard, when two Chicagoans, Ward Christensen and Randy Seuss, launched the nation's first computerized bulletin board system, or BBS. They had met a few years earlier through the Chicago Area Computer Hobbyists Exchange and thought it would be cool to share information over some kind of computerized messaging system. Snowed in and with time to tinker, they created the system from scratch. Christensen wrote the software and Seuss built the computer. Here's Randy Seuss in the 2005 film, BBS, the documentary.
The whole BBS thing was for our computer club to be able to produce newsletters. That was the whole idea of it. It worked. From wherever it went from then, fine.
Seuss and Christensen gave away their software for free.
The system planted a seed that would grow into the modern internet. We want to thank Clint Cargill for that report here on Statewide. A deported veteran from Chicago finally returned home after nearly two decades. The Vietnam-era veteran was laid to rest at the Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery near Joliet. Maria Inez Zamudio has that story.
The soldiers carefully fold an American flag as the wailing is drowned by the traditional sounds of this military funeral. A snowstorm and frigid winter temperatures couldn't keep the family of Javier Ramirez from honoring his life. He was 70. Javier Ramirez was a Vietnam-era Marine. He was caught in this country's complicated immigration system. He was deported almost two decades ago.
Chicago was his home, you know, and I did, for many years, I stayed quiet about his deportation. And it was towards when he started getting sick that I started making noise.
That's Claudia Ramirez. His daughter. She's upset her father didn't have access to a VA hospital. He died of cancer in Mexico. He had to travel 6 hours for cancer treatment, which he paid for himself.
And his cancer is linked to the Vietnam era. He had multiple myeloma.
Research has linked this type of cancer to chemicals veterans were exposed to during that time. Claudia said her father deserved better.
I was really angry. You know, when he passed away in Mexico, I didn't want anything to do with this country anymore. I felt like they kind of like backstabbed him or they murdered him with these laws.
The Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996 changed his life. Under this law, his green card was revoked after a drug-related felony. His lawyer never told him his conviction would get him deported. He didn't fight the deportation. His plan was to quickly leave the country and return to reunite with his family here. Claudia remembers what his father told her.
I have to be with my son because my brother was in the hospital. He was near death. So my dad wanted to be here. He said, I'm not going to wait in immigration. It could take years to fight your case.
He returned to Mexico, but quickly came back. But this time, illegally. He was caught and charged with a federal crime. He spent 2 years in prison, thanks to that same immigration law.
He got deported again, and he stopped fighting after that. He was just, yes, we cancelled me. He's like, I can't do this no more. You know, they're going to get me and I'm too old. I'm going to go to jail.
The family separated and he was forced to live alone in San Luis Potosí, Mexico. But in 2019, the family had a glimmer of hope. By then, dozens of deported veterans were organizing to bring attention to this problem. And in November, Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth traveled to Tijuana to celebrate Veterans Day with a group of deported veterans. Ramirez attended with his wife and Claudia. Claudia said she expected the new administration to allow deported veterans back into the country.
And what's hard about bringing the veterans back?
Claudia said she's going to continue fighting to change the laws that broke her family. But as she grieves the loss of her father, she's also trying to heal from the punishing guilt of not being able to bring him back alive.
I really feel like I failed him. And everyone's like, oh, Brita, you did such a good job bringing your dad back. But I don't feel like I did. I feel like I failed him. And there's no coming back.
Javier Ramirez loved music. He sang and played the piano. And in the 70s, he was a member of a well-known Chicago band. Los Aristócratas de Chicago. He even performed at the Republican convention. But Claudia can't remember the year. She said his music will keep him alive. María Inés Zamudio, WBEZ News.
There's more of Statewide coming up. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a well-known sports writer has written about his grandson who died from substance abuse. He shares the story. That's just ahead. COVID-19 mitigation restrictions for things like indoor dining have been loosened as case rates fall in Illinois. It's the county health department's job to enforce those rules. So what actually happens when someone files a complaint that a business is ignoring safety guidelines? Peter Medlin with WNIJ decided to find out.
Local businesses have struggled to stay afloat during the pandemic. 17% of U.S. restaurants have closed due to COVID-19. They've swung from closed to open with restrictions to closed again, and some have operated in spite of mitigation rules, potentially putting customers and employees at risk of the virus. Between August 2020 and the end of January 2021, the DeKalb County Health Department received nearly 400 COVID-19 complaints from employees or customers spanning over 100 businesses. Greg Maurice is the Director of Health Protection at the DeKalb County Health Department. He says the first step for his department is to reach out to those businesses, get their side of the story, and inform them of the current mitigation rules in place. No fines or penalties right away.
Always our main goal was always to try to educate, give people opportunities to come into compliance, and multiple opportunities at that.
According to county records via the Freedom of Information Act, restaurants and bars saw the most complaints, typically for violating indoor service rules. But a variety of businesses like gyms, gas stations, post offices, even churches and a police department also had complaints. And they went beyond indoor dining to employee masking, lack of distancing, employees working with symptoms or positive cases, or warning of a potential outbreak.
Once we get consecutive complaints that would come in regarding the facility, you know, if they're, I'll say, similar in nature, then we would go to performing a site visit, doing an inspection to verify the complaint.
Sometimes on those site visits, inspectors discover that locations aren't actually breaking the rules at all. They're even taking extra precautions. Local law enforcement will also inform the health department if they conduct a site visit that verifies a violation, often with photographic evidence. A handful of businesses racked up more than a dozen complaints. One DeKalb County restaurant had 45 complaints over the course of several months, the most of any business. And even as multiple complaints come in, Maurice says the health department's priority is still education. They do additional visits to explain they're in violation and wait to see if the complaints stop. Then they'll drop off a written warning.
The step after that written warning was doing the visit, verifying again that they are still violating it, giving them an order to disperse letter, which would basically state that customers need to vacate, employees need to vacate until they comply.
The health department gives them around 24 to 48 hours to come into compliance before they recheck. And there is one final step if yet again a business refuses to abide by COVID-19 safety rules.
We're referring them over to our legal, so state's attorney's office, to see if there was anything legally that wanted to be pursued for them.
Maurice says the department has had to do that, but extremely rarely. Fewer than 10 cases have gotten to that point. He says he understands the frustration businesses feel, especially restaurants that can't seat people outside in sub-zero temperatures. But they don't want them to close down. They just want them to operate in the safest way possible.
We get a lot of pushback, I think a lot there, you know, saying that the health department's trying to close all these places down. It's absolutely not true.
Chicago recently expanded their indoor dining capacity, and every region of Illinois is now in phase 4 of the state's reopening plan. Maury says in DeKalb County that means bars and restaurants are open for limited indoor service for up to 25 people or 25% occupancy.
And a lot of the local health departments, we're all pushing to have some, like, just limitations on the indoor dining versus just a full closure of it.
Emergency rules established last August by Governor J.B. Pritzker opened the door for businesses to be penalized for not adhering to indoor dining bans or enforcing masks. And several businesses in Illinois have faced fines over $1,000 for defying the orders. As the state moves into mitigation tiers with looser restrictions, Maurice says the number of COVID-19 complaints is likely to dwindle. Illinois residents can still file complaints of unsafe conditions with their county's health department over the phone or on the department's website. I'm Peter Medlin.
The pandemic has affected incidences of substance abuse and how people struggling with addiction are treated. Chase Cavanaugh has more on that.
Social distancing and isolation have become everyday features of the pandemic. These stresses, along with factors like job loss, have resulted in more instances of substance abuse. That's according to Marissa Kirsch, Kirsch is a licensed clinical social worker with Northwestern Medicine. She says more people are drinking greater amounts of alcohol, or taking up the habit if they haven't before.
There's alcohol easily accessible to them and available to them at earlier times than before, and they don't have to worry about getting up the next day or being available at a certain time. So that's definitely increased a lot since the pandemic has begun.
Opiate abuse is also on the rise among adults, with more people dying from overdoses. Dr. Tom Wright is the chief medical officer of Rosecrans Health Network. He says in some cases, a negative change in mental health can be a factor.
It's not a particular event that they're attempting suicide at that point in time, but they just sort of stop caring about their life so that they just sort of continue to use more and more and use to the point where it ends up being an overdose and they end up dying from it. Maybe not intentionally, but sort of indirectly would be the best way I could put it.
Wright says more teenagers have taken to vaping nicotine or smoking marijuana. This has led to some complications.
At our residential adolescent unit, we're seeing a lot more kids coming in with psychotic disorders. And what I mean by psychotic disorders is disorders that sort of show up by hallucinations, hearing things or seeing things that aren't there, paranoia, that kind of thing. And we know that marijuana can uncover or make that worse in teenagers.
The pandemic has also made it more difficult for some patients to seek care. Kirsch says she already sees this when trying to get someone into inpatient or residential treatment.
Even just to get like a phone screening to even be considered for the wait list can be a little bit of a wait. We're having a pretty large challenge of just getting our clients into that higher level of care and getting them to stay sober long enough to complete the requirements to be eligible for higher level of care.
Wright says for other patients, financial difficulties have affected access to care.
A lot of people have lost their jobs. Unemployment is high, lack of insurance, lack of coverage for some of this. So I think that's prevented a lot of people from seeking as much treatment as they probably should at this point in time.
Beyond these concerns, a fear of infection and the need to social distance means that new precautions have had to be taken. Dr. Wright says some patient treatment has had to shift to a virtual setting. But Wright says some of this can't be done remotely.
There are some of our clients, particularly if they're severely mentally ill or in really great need, they need to have that face-to-face contact. And so we continue to do that, but we do it in rooms that allow for physical distancing and certainly wear masks and things like that.
For less severe cases of mental health and substance abuse, there's been a shift to telemedicine. Kirsch says video conferencing can help her and other social workers notice signs of withdrawal or drug abuse.
I can tell just by what I'm seeing on their screen that there's, you know, maybe alcohol in the background, or I can tell that they're sitting on the floor of a house that looks unsafe, or whatever the case may be.
Kirsch also notes that telemedicine has also helped patients who've gone off the radar.
I think that they're more likely to answer those calls, knowing exactly who they're going to be speaking to, and knowing that we care enough that we keep calling and we keep checking in on them.
As for the future, Dr. Wright says staff and patients at Rosecrans are continually monitored for COVID-19, but recent immunizations have helped.
Most of our clinical staff that has direct care responsibilities have been able to be vaccinated since they're part of 1A, the 1A tier.
He says this is especially important if new outbreaks pop up. As for Northwestern Medicine, Kirsch says they may offer more telemedicine even after pandemic restrictions loosen.
I think some of those things can continue to be utilized with the added value of them coming in person and seeing us face-to-face and being able to get actual eyes on them, being able to actually drug screen them in person and have that connection that you build more easily and strongly in person.
But even as progress is being made against COVID-19, these health systems will need to ensure both that they can account for the rise in substance abuse and offer enough treatment to the patients they already have. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
Dave Kindred is a Central Illinois native who became a legendary sports writer, perhaps best known for his relationship with the late Muhammad Ali. Now Kindred decided to write about something deeply personal, the death of his grandson to substance abuse. He spoke with Eric Stock about his memoir, Leave Out the Tragic Parts, and shares the story of his grandson Jared, who likely started drinking at the age of 13 after his parents split up.
When he died, I'm a writer. You know, writers write. And it was my way of dealing with the grief. And so I just reconstructed his life as best I could by talking to his friends, people who traveled with him on the road. When I say traveled, it's, you know, not in a trailways bus, you know, they're riding freight trains around America, living wherever they can sleep. So, you know, in the end, Eric, it was just a book that I could not write. I had to write it. I had to express my feelings about him, about addiction. He was an alcoholic, probably from his teenage years. And I wanted people to understand that he was a sweetheart. He was not some bum on the street.
Was it cathartic for you?
In a way, but not really, you know, not really. You know, it's been 7 years now. You know, it took me a long time to write it because I wanted it to be as good as I could make it. It took me a long time to find people that had been with him. But nah, it didn't change anything. I miss him every day. Why I did it, you know, it's a good story to begin with. It's a facet of American life that most people don't know at all. One of my characters, one of his friends, said it's an underbelly of America that people don't even know exists. You know, so I wanted to do it because it told a story about youth, about kids, you know, who feel left out, kids who feel pain. But it's an important book in the sense that he didn't choose to be addicted. Addicted chose him.
You had said about the memoir that you wanted readers to stand and talk with Jared for a little while and maybe learn something from him. What did you learn about him in retracing his life after you had become disconnected from him and his family?
Well, I think that all of those kids, all those people, some of them are 30 years old, on the road like that, are running from something. You know, they're running from pain of some kind, you know, a psychic pain, physical pain. But what I learned about Jared on the road was that he was the same kid who used to sleep with me when he was 7, 8 years old. And I'd tell him bedtime stories. He was the same sweetheart, same fun-loving kid that he always was. I have a great friend in San Francisco. I showed him a picture of Jared on the road, and he kind of withdrew and said, now, if I saw him walking down the street toward me, I'd cross the street to get away from him. And I said, well, you'd be making a big mistake. You know, he's a sweetheart. You know, what you have to do is ignore the dirt, ignore the grease and the grime, ignore the scars real and imagined, and see under there that there's a human being. He's not invisible.
Do you know if Jared ever went to get help or his family tried to steer him in that direction? Or did they just not see the signs?
Well, they didn't see the signs in time, for sure. Because by the time that we all reached out to him, I did too, it was too late. You know, my son had him, to quote my son, within an inch of going to a rehab place in Culpeper, Virginia. His mother tells a story about, you know, she's an amateur photographer. She was doing a book where she would take people to the beach in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and have them write a word in the sand as to what they would want washed out of their life. The tide would come in and wash away that word. She asked Jared one time, Jared, let's go to the beach. You write one word in the beach. And the word that he wrote in the beach was booze. And that told me that he understood the problem, but he couldn't do anything about it.
How different was this for you, writing and reporting on sports for much of your career, now to writing about something so deeply personal about your grandson?
I thought, first of all, you know, I'm a writer. You know, I've written about sports because that's what I knew. That's where I had grown up. And but in sports, I didn't care who won. I wrote about people and ideas. And that's what this book was, people and ideas. It was very personal in a sense that I thought it was the only way that it would work if you just told the truth. You know, and I didn't, of course, I loved him, my grandson, so I cut him whatever slack that implies. Leave out the tragic parts is the title. I didn't leave out very much of the tragic parts. But it was a story that I thought needed to be told, and the only way that people are going to accept it as the truth is if it's raw and if it's honest. And that's what I did from beginning to end.
That's writer Dave Kindred talking with Eric Stock. Kindred says he's now writing a book about his wife's struggles following a stroke she suffered 5 years ago, and how his appreciation for the girls' basketball team at Morton High School has provided an escape from the darkness. That's all we have time for this week on Statewide. We're glad you could join us and be back here again next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Statewide is available through our podcast on the NPR One app. You can also find all of our shows at statewideshow.com. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.